to do.
This is quite true.
All right, boys and girls, welcome to the week in IndyCar News. This is our first leading into the Indy 500. We're downstairs in the media center, third floor, so you're going to hear elevator opening. You're going to hear the little drink thing in the back opening and people talking, so it's not exactly clean audio. We have our normal 1-2 punch, Robin Miller.
We have asshole.
Yes, we have we have Stefan Wilson and Michael Cannon. Michael, who engineers Ed Jones, number 19, Dale Coyne racing Honda. Steph Wilson, who should be in this race and is going to be in the race next year, no matter what.
Amen.
All right, so we have a big race coming up this weekend. I figure we'll save all the kind of analysis from the driver's side, engineering side, for the very end, get some predictions, and no, we're not letting you give us, no, I don't know, you're going to give answers, damn it. Let's start off with the big news of the week and what has frankly been a pretty amazing story. Our boy Sebastian Bourdais, monster crash, but walking out of the damn hospital, heading to the rehabilitation facility. Michael, part of your team, what's that been like internally? Your team owner is Dale Coyne's got a big heart. I know he doesn't take this stuff lightly, but you guys have rallied.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that is the most difficult for the team is that team is very much built around Sebastian.
Yeah.
Right? And such high hopes. Things were going very, very well. And then have the rug pulled out from this small but really hardworking earnest group. It's been tough, but at the same time they've rallied. They've put together a good car for James, and are optimistic of a good run.
James Davison, who'll be stepping in for this race in the number 19. Robin, I mean, we've seen a lot of people hurt here in the past. You've seen people killed here in the past. You're, I don't know, I guess fortunate, that probably is the right word. You've seen it enough to when you witness a Bourdais crash or Dan at Las Vegas or Justin, do you still get that holy shit, thing inside of you when you see a Bourdais crash? Or how do you react?
Well, the first years I hung around racing, we went to Kunkel's funeral home twice a month because somebody was getting killed in a midget sprint car and IndyCar. So you get numb to that, and then when it becomes safer and safer, and then it's almost a shock if somebody loses their life. Of course, in Justin's case, the most unjust and unbelievably fluke way to lose. I mean, but when you see a crash like Bourdais, 20 years ago he'd have died. 30 years ago there'd have been no question. Maybe 10 years ago he lost his legs and his arm. And your story about safety, and when the car stopped and you saw him trying to put up his shield, you'd think, okay, he's alive. You just don't know, but I just think that what happens is Michael race, Steph races. When you race, you don't think it's going to be you, but everybody knows that, I remember when I was racing midgets and this guy started, I got to know him in the driver's meeting and he was in my heat race and we went in the feature and he got killed and his wife and his kid were there. I didn't even know him, and you're trying to figure out, but then it didn't make you quit. So some people, I think, just look at it and say, unfortunately, it's part of this business, and thankfully, it just doesn't happen very often anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I grew up in an era when my dad was racing, and injuries and deaths were pretty common. I will say that, one of the popular targets in the paddock is the tech crew and the guys that come up with these rules. But at the same time, if you think about Sebastian's accident, as Marshall touched upon in his article, you think about Sebastian's accident at Sonoma. They learned something, they implemented changes. Same thing with James's accident, with Justin's accident at Fontana. And if you look at the condition of the survival cell from Sebastian's accident, every single one of those components contributed to his safety. The lower wishbone took a run at him, but it couldn't get through because we'd add these great big Cylon panels.
Right?
Yeah. Same thing, the cockpit surround, which had cracked at Sonoma when Newgarden and Bourdais got together, that was intact. It had been strengthened because of what they'd seen there. And, we piss and moan when we get these updates. Bloody hell, we're going to add more weight to the car, and more weight to the car, and more weight to the car. And all of a sudden, when you have an enormous accident like this, you're suddenly very, very grateful for the actions they've taken. And that's, you know, that's not just kudos to Dallara, that's kudos to people like Jeff Horton and to Bill Pappas and people like that, that are proactive, that take a look at this stuff and just go, don't just look at it and go, well, that's what happens in an accident.
Right.
They look at it and go, this can be better.
So this might be a little bit awkward, Steph. It's not meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big topics this week has been, why the hell wasn't Steph Wilson put in that car? And it, you know, I don't want to say it's the elephant in the room. I mean, we're grown men. We're living great lives. So Dale Coyne has been on the receiving end of a couple articles, and you know, a number of folks have been mad that you weren't in the car. I know Robin and I think everyone here would have loved to have seen you in the car. You certainly wanted to be in the car. There's also a couple other aspects that I think we understand. Maybe some of those outside the sport don't. I don't know if folks fully appreciate how hard Dale took your brother's loss. If we look at Sonoma 2015, Justin was in an Andretti car at Pocono. But if you're at Sonoma 2015, the weekend after, Dale's car actually had more tributes. I mean, so Justin wasn't even driving for Dale when he had the accident, yet Dale was the one who had the most demonstrative memorials to him. There's a part of me that thinks, as much as we would love to have you in the car, I don't know if Dale could stomach the thought, just from a risk and a fear standpoint.
Yeah, that was something that was brought up to me as a potential reason why, you know, but at the same time, you know, I went and saw Dale, and I said, look, you know, I don't want to let my, you know, obviously what's happened to my family, what's happened to Justin, your connection with Justin affect my chances of being in the race car, because yeah, I am my own person, I am my own driver, and at the same time, you know, we all strap in the race car, we all know the risks, and that was, I'm still accepting that risk when I strap in the race car, even though I know exactly what could happen. You know, I've seen Justin get hurt, I've seen what can happen, the absolute worst can happen, and lift that, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, this is a sport that we choose to do, this is a sport we love, and I think Justin would be, you know, upset if he let what happened to him affect, if I let that affect my career and like my goals, you know. I think he would want me to strive forward myself, you know. So I just wanted to, you know, I needed to say that to Dale and make sure he knew that, like, whatever concern you have about putting me in the car from that standpoint, that it shouldn't be an issue. Like, I'm here, my own driver, and I'm accepting the risk just like any driver. Just treat me like any other driver.
I told Steph, we were standing there waiting to see Dale, and I said, you're too nice a guy, because he, you know, said he wanted to be respectful. I remember being at the Hoosier 100 when somebody's upside down on the straightaway and the radiator's spouting water, and there's two guys on either side of the car saying, he's probably not going to be at Terre Haute tomorrow, but I will be. And it's just,
yeah,
it's not being ghoulish or anything. It's just being, it's part of the business, and you just have to stand up for yourself. And I think he appreciated the fact probably that you sent him, you know, you didn't go run up, but I would have. I'd have tackled him. I said, hey, I want to drive that thing.
Yeah,
well, not to be rude, because I believe he's still alive, but I was part of Sam Schmidt's team in 2001 when we were at Texas when Davey Hamilton had his god-awful crash. And, you know, there are definite degrees to severity, but having been there, having seen the front of the tub shorn off at about mid-thigh, having to go help grab towels and paper towels and mop blood off the side of the car, I mean, a fairly visual representation of what just happened, and then listening to, and I'm not mentioning it for that reason, but having seen that, been a part of it, everyone pulling for Davey, and then of course the natural, so who do we put in the car? And then listening to Sam privately, and I'll share this because it was, you know, 15-16 years ago, you start hearing about the calls he's getting and the emails he's getting, and you're going, oh, that guy's good, yeah, that's a great option, oh, that guy's good. Jeff Wood hasn't driven an Indy car in 10 years, and he thinks he's the guy to step right in. And you start getting some of those, and you're like, those almost become kind of, you know, inner paddock, like Hall of Fame. You're like, oh my God, do you believe this guy rang up thinking? You standing outside, that's a natural fit. hopefully next year, well, I shouldn't say hopefully, next year we're not going to be having this conversation because you are going to be in an Indy car.
Yeah, no, I think you guys touched on it. You know, it's really hard as a driver because you want to be respectful to what's happened. And, you know, at the same time, you know, there's a bunch of drivers here that have tried to make that leap from Indy Lights to IndyCar, and it's not happened, and we're just on the outside looking in. And, you know, we're all, you know, it's not a glamorous lifestyle. We're all on ramen noodles every night. You
You're
know?
Sitting and here with you just, Miller,
you know,
Pruitt and Cannon at 3:51 on a Thursday, and you're telling us this isn't glamour in the media center? I tell you what.
No,
it's a darkened room.
Yes. So, I mean, we're all just so hungry, and we all just know, like, that an opportunity like that with a good team, and clearly what Dale's built is pretty incredible, you know, to see them win races this year, winning races and running up the front consistently. And I was stud with them in the qualifying line, actually, with one of the team guys that, you know, has been around for years, but obviously was there with Justin as well. And I was like, you know, you guys got something for the pole. And we saw those first two laps come up, and you're just like, wow, this is so freaking cool, you know, to see Dale Coyne potentially going for the pole here. So, yeah, you know, it like I said, it's a really fine balance. I wanted to be respectful of Dale, and at the same time, I really wanted to make sure that I was at least heard and at least listened to and sort of at least on the short list. I didn't want to be looking back on Monday morning going, man, if I just spoke to Dale, you know? So it's finding that fine line of being respectful and at the same time also wanting to push yourself forward, you know? So
you might have been on the short list when you're 5. You're on the tall list, bro. What the hell are you talking about? So this week we had IndyCar unveil new renderings of the 2018 Universal bodywork. We'd seen little glimpses of what they might do with the rear wing package. Jay Fry told me earlier in the week that car is 99% of what we're going to see. So, you know, kind of remove the percentage of what it might. That's essentially the car. What do you guys think? We saw the speedway trim, which we'd kind of seen before, but this was more defined. Really saw the road course package for the first time. What do you guys think?
I love it. You know, from a driver's standpoint, I mean, it looks like the old, can I say it? The old champ car.
Please. Of course you're going to say it. Right,
oh, yeah. We're going to move this outside.
you got a race-winning champ car engineer here.
Security.
It looks incredible from a driver standpoint. I just, man, I can't wait to drive it on the oval. Hopefully, I'd love to have it go on the road course as well, you know.
So. Mike, did you guys have, you think Jay's been really good about talking to people like drivers and engineers, and do you think it represents kind of what the paddock wanted?
Yeah, the car's appropriate, right? You can identify it as an Indy car now. The current car, the car that Dallara delivered was very much a styling exercise dictated by the series. I mean, that's what the series was keen on. It was not driven, it was not engineering driven. They sort of came up with a shape and said, okay, we need to balance this thing. Now we've sort of gone back to what is a performance-oriented vehicle. It you know, it looks very much like what an IndyCar is. When you tell somebody what you work on IndyCars, that's pretty much the shape and size and layout that they have in their brain. I think Tina Belli, Bill Pappas have been incredibly diligent in making sure they hit all the performance targets with this car. And it's very tricky. I mean, we're expecting this car to go as fast or maybe even faster than what the current car is going. And, you know, it's a pretty broad brush that you've got to use when you build these things, right? It's got to go quick on the street circuit. It's got to go quick at Elkhart Lake. It's got to go fast at Iowa. It's got to go around Phoenix, well, and it's got to challenge the track record at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So, you know, it's a very tricky thing to lay out. I think the car aesthetically is pleasing, but I think you'll also find that the aesthetics are due to the performance targets they set for themselves.
So looking at the car itself, Michael, and this is part that I think would be interesting to talk about a little bit. So one of their goals is to reduce downforce on the car, and not just once. So their plan is to have this car come out next year. Tina told me about a 15% downforce reduction from max downforce in the current road course, everything on it package. And then they want to take a little bit more off. I don't know what that bottom number is going to be when they get there, but what do you think that should do from a theoretical, for maybe just sticking road course performance standpoint, if you're taking 700-800 pounds of downforce away for your maximum, is that going to take enough away from the corners to make a lap time grow, or will that also help if we're talking straight line speed, knowing that you've got 800 less pounds of downforce and drag to carry through? How do you think that'll play out?
Well, yeah, you're always working with efficiencies with racing cars, and you know, they're trying to make as efficient a package as possible. At the same time, they're realistic. The one thing that struck me when we went to Elkhart Lake last year was how quick the cars were in the corners. I mean, they were shockingly fast. And from a driver standpoint, from an engineering standpoint, it's genuinely impressive. You know, places where, you know, there was a good long lift in the middle of the corner in the older cars that had 800 and 900 horsepower. These things, I mean, they were just flat stick, and they're going faster. I mean, the G-forces around the carousel at Elkhart. Turn 13 was flat. Turn 7 was flat. 10, 12 miles an hour quicker than the old Indy cars. But at the same time, the VMAX, the top speed, was uninspiring. We used to go there, and on Saturdays, we always tried the setback rear wing. That was good for 203 miles an hour into turn one. And now, you know, it's a struggle to get 187 miles an hour out of the thing. So, you know, they've worked on the efficiency of the package. I think they're a little bit more viscerally exciting because they're going to be running quicker with less drag. They're using less top body downforce and more underbody downforce, which is very efficient downforce. Yeah. So I'm very keen to see the car run.
I'm going to step into something real quick that unfortunately Michael and Steph, you weren't there for. Robin, last night, part of Indy every year, the treat for me are the dinners that R. Miller and Steve Shunk put together. Last night was a wonderful one where we had Uncle Bobby, Bobby Unser, Parnelli Jones. Uncle Bobby was enjoying his whiskey, so that was certainly a lot of fun. There are some great stories told last night, brother, but tell me about that. Just, you do a lot of these, but I have to imagine you still just love sitting back listening to these crazy tales. It's also kind of a tradition this month of May behind the scenes, too.
Think about this. When you think about Unser and Parnelli, and he hates it because he's the oldest living Indy winner now, and Foyt and those guys, and you grew up watching them, and that's why you got hooked on racing, and you think that they started at 145 miles an hour and Foyt quit, he was going 225, and you think about all the things they saw in terms of safety and all the evolution of the race cars and stuff, and Parnelli is so humble that every time somebody stops him for his autograph, he's like, I can't believe anybody knows who I am, and I can't believe anybody wants my autograph. And I said, no, that's how much you guys meant to him. So what's fun for them is they come back to, I mean, I think that we had lunch today with Bill Vukovich and Jigger Saroy and Poncho Carter and Parnelli and Uncle Bobby. And, you know, we tell the same stories a lot, although the cat story is probably a good one to...
You want to tell
the
cat story?
We'll tell
the
cat story when one time they decided that they were bored. This is the other thing. Today's race drivers, unfortunately, have real lives. They don't just run rampant during the day and wait till a dirt race at night.
Is this what you're being told? Okay.
So yeah. This is the setting is, I believe, Southern California. There's a flight instructor who's been instructing a lot of IndyCar drivers in the 60s, 70s to fly their own little private, you know, single-engine planes, and Roger McCluskey.
Roger McCluskey was deadly scared of flying because he'd flown with Unser and Parnelli so much that he thought, my God, this can't be the norm. If you think racing in the 60s was dangerous, flying with these guys, and Jim Herdebees, who I flew with, and so they're all bored, and they said, let's take this thing up in the air and throw a cat out and see if he lands on his feet, because there's a bunch of cats around this airport. So McCluskey
as
says,
you would do,
as you do when you're bored, right? You and your pals. So they go up in this little Cessna or whatever it was, and they notice that it goes like this a couple of times.
Waving around,
they make another pass, and it waves around. So when the plane lands, McCluskey gets out, and he looks like a landmine blew up because he's bleeding from the top of his head, all his arms. The cat never made it out of the plane because you couldn't throw a cat out of an airplane. So
he went to throw the cat out of the plane. The cat held onto his arm, ran back up his arm, ripped his arms to shreds, clawed his head to shreds. They land, and so that's why Parnelli and everyone, Bobby's watching this plane take off smoothly, and all of a sudden it looks like it's about to crash, and then it comes to land, and it looks like it's about to crash, and yeah, McCluskey gets out bleeding like he just lost a knife fight. No, I didn't know. That cat said, F you. I'm not going out the plane.
PETA members, please send your letters and cars to the following address.
That's right. But They
I was wondering where that was going.
I think the thing we can't appreciate about that you can, because your father was in a dangerous era when he raced, is that they lived for the moment. They didn't have 401ks. They didn't have PR people. They didn't have a long-range plan. They were like, let's race. Let's go to the bar. Let's try and pick up a chick, and let's go to the next race. That was their plan.
Do you know what but I will say this, because this still exists, but not on that plane necessarily. But every guy that you meet that is a championship race car driver, Scott Dixon, Dario Franchitti, Paul Tracy, these are all very, very bright people. These people would be successful in anything they did. They're type A high achievers, and that's how they live their lives. Right. And yeah, there was that component then. There's you know, a certain component, you know, the test pilot mentality. My godfather was a test pilot. Yeah. He was the most strict by the book guy when he was on duty. And he was a raving engulfed maniac when he wasn't. You know, that personality still exists. And working with these championship drivers, Sebastian is the most intense person I have ever met in my entire life. And
really?
And as I say, these people would be successes at anything they did. If they said, I'm going to open a car wash and wash cars by hand, 5 years from there, you'd have 750 of those outlets throughout the country that were successful. You know, these are genuinely impressive people.
I see Steph thinking about opening car washes right now. So, okay. All right, let's blast through the last couple of topic-y items, a couple of topics before we get to the big race on Sunday. Had a couple people raise this item. I have a definite opinion on it. James Davison will be participating in the Indianapolis 500, having not turned four laps of qualifying. Having gotten in the car for the first time after qualifying was over. This is a place built on traditions. We seem to knock a couple of those off and bury them each year. This question is nothing, that's actually exactly why we invited you, Michael, but the concept of a driver participating in a race when he failed to turn a lap prior to anything, prior to the proverbial gun going off at the end of qualifying on Sunday, thoughts? Good, bad, don't let it happen again.
It's the last tradition that's left is 11 rows of three, and they're going to ensure that no matter what it takes. And they've got a rule in the IndyCar book, just like USAC had, just like everybody's ever had. We can do whatever we want to do to fill the field, and that's basically what it is.
Yeah, the rule book, I mean, there's the proviso in there. It's, you know, you follow this rule, and then there is also the chief stewards at their discretion. And in this case, I mean, I think they made the right decision. I mean, we want 33 cars for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yes.
It's kind of like last year when Tagliani crashed in qualifying. You know, he qualified technically with no time, you know, but I think, like you said, it's just having 11 rows of free and kind of brush under the table why, you know, there's the 33rd has no time, you know. So
I've been here twice when they had 11 rows of three and two extras.
Yeah, exactly.
They started 35 cars in 1979 and 1997.
Yep.
It's a long story, brother. I don't want to give you more gray hair than you already got.
All right, so last topic. This is just a cool one that I think maybe piggyback Seb. So yesterday, our friend, former IndyCar driver, Mimmo Gidley, first time back in a proper race car since just smashing the hell out of himself in a really horrible crash at Daytona in 2014. This isn't maybe so much of a question, but good God, wasn't that just like the coolest surprise that they had for him? And how cool is it to know that he's ready to come back?
So tell him what he get to do.
Well, he was invited to Sonoma Raceway, his former team, Bob Stallings Racing, who's driving their Red Dragon Corvette DP in that crash. Obviously, Mimmo lives in the Bay Area, was invited up to come see them test there. And a few days before, it said, by the way, bring your helmet and your gear. We're going to put you in the car for the first time. So he'd been doing karting after rehabilitating himself, but this was his first real chance to find out if he was all the way back, and he said yes. So just as someone who Michael engineered against him, and you know, we all have a big affinity for him.
He was in the Players Forsyth car to replace Patrick after Patrick fell off his luggage, whatever it was, his RM125 luggage. We had the pleasure of running him for a couple races. As a matter of fact, we almost won. We were on our way to winning Rio, and we had a wastegate issue. So I got a lot of time for Mimmo. I mean, that guy is a hard charger, fabulous personality, lovely, lovely guy.
He almost won Cleveland for Ganassi.
Yep.
They got rid of him because he wasn't very good qualifier. Yep. That's what they said. The guy's a hell of a race driver.
Yep.
Hell of a race driver.
Well, we were we were shocked because at the end of it, every session at Long Beach, for example, he was always the quickest at the end of the straightaway. It's like, what do we, you know, we're just running the same arrow as Tag's car is, and you know, the other guys that are running Cosworth. And if you went into the data, you looked, and I mean, he'd come out of the hairpin and run it all the way up to maximum RPM, where a lot of guys are short shifting because it gets a bit hectic, right? He had the most incredible feel for an engine. He was very, very good that way. He had some tremendous performances with us, and the guys loved him. Just tremendous personality, and very, very quick.
Tell this to staff, he'll love this. The first time he was driving for Dale Coyne, they missed the Friday practice session because his car wasn't ready. The next race, he went to the shop and helped put the car together to make sure they were going to make the first practice session.
Cool.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Well, we've got a little 500-mile race on Sunday, or possibly Monday, depending on what the weather decides to do. Michael, you've got a hell of a young driver in Ed Jones who's been just looking like a veteran all year long. What are you looking at this weekend from a plan standpoint, strategy standpoint? What do you do with a rook who would love nothing more than to flip Fernando Alonso the bird as he goes by?
It's not impossible either. Ed's completely immune to pressure. It doesn't exist for him.
Wow.
You know, he's very perfunctory in how he goes about doing this. To him, it's a challenge to do 200 laps, to do those 800 corners absolutely perfectly, and that's what he'll go out and do.
Wow.
You know, we talked a lot about this before the season started with Ed, and you know, as a rookie in this series, when you think about the people that are in this series, when you think of the Scott Dixons and the Tony Kanaans and all these drivers, these high quality guys, Will Power, these guys have been doing it for so many years, you are not going to ever steal a march on them, right? So you've got to go out there, you've got to learn your craft, you've got to watch them, learn from them, and hopefully there are some mistakes on their part that you don't make, and you benefit from that, and you move a little bit forward, a little bit forward, a little bit forward. Being a rookie in this series has got to be the hardest thing there is. But at the same time, he's had a fast car, he's done a great job with it, and I think we'll be pleasantly surprised by where he finishes on Sunday.
So, Steph, you were an Indy 500 rookie last year. Difference between you and Fernando Alonso is you were handed a shitbox to drive last year. He's in a pretty solid car, one that we wouldn't mind seeing you in. What did you learn last year as a rook taking the green flag and the insanity of barreling into turn one and then trying to do it for as long as possible until your shitbox didn't let you play anymore? What doesn't Fernando know that he's going to have to find out when things get busy?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I thought he would have a hard time dealing with, you know, the traffic and running in dirty air, you know, and where to place your car to still try and catch some downforce, you know, when you get into four or five cars deep, you know. But it looks like in the practice sessions, I mean, Andretti have done a really good job of getting him all that experience that they can get. I mean, he looks like he's handling it all pretty well, but I think it's just the unknown that I think could catch him out. You just never know if he catches a wake wrong. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Aloshin almost crash on Monday.
His birthday.
You know, that happened so quickly. And I wonder how the car looks dialed in, like all the Andretti cars look dialed in, when something like that catches him, if you know, by surprise, is he going to have the experience? Is he going to be able to react quickly enough and put the right inputs in? So I think that's going to be the question mark there, is the unknowns. And I think as the race goes on, you know, talking about who's got chances, I think if it's kind of a fuel mileage race and who's quickest while saving fuel, I think Fernando's in a great spot. I think if there's a yellow with 10 laps to go and it's a shootout, then it's going to be hard to compete with the guys that have got 20 years in this series, the Kanaans, the Elios, the Dixons, the Hunter Rays, the guys that have done this race 20 times. You know, for a rookie, you know, I can't imagine, you know, trying to outsmart those guys. It's surely going to be pretty tough for him.
Yeah, I would agree. I will say this, though, that the as you touched upon, quality car, right? Mm-hmm. And you did the Speedway last year, and you know it can be very, very tricky when you're in traffic. Last year we had the great pleasure running Brian Clausen, and Brian had done the Speedway previously, and he got in our car and he drove our car, and he said, "You gotta be kidding me! I had no idea." I had no idea. And so the same thing with Sebastian. Sebastian got in the car, and Sebastian, at no point last year did Sebastian feature, did he? Right? He gets in the car, he goes out, drives around traffic, and he goes, "You gotta be kidding me. This is night and day. This is like a light switch has been thrown." So Fernando's running in that situation. He's got a really good, solid car.
Yeah.
And I personally would be shocked to see Fernando make a mistake on Sunday.
Mario Andretti said, pretty good guy to talk to about it, said, "I would have never dreamed what I'm going to tell you," but he says, "That guy's got a chance to win the race."
Yes.
And he said, and his spotter, Dane Carter, I had lunch with today, and he said, "I haven't seen him, his line's unbelievable." He said, the guy didn't start running until May 3rd. I realize he's got a great package and all that, but he's never been on an oval.
Stop talking about his package.
Unbelievable. So,
short fingers, though.
All I'm telling you is I'm going to the NBC production meeting. I appreciate you guys being here. Keep talking. I'm betting Ryan Hunter Ray at 12-1, $10,000 to win. See me at the pay window.
Rookie of the year.
Are we doing choices now? Are we doing picks?
We'll get there. Yeah.
You're going to get there. I got to go.
Son of a bitch is leaving and trying to speed us up. I'm not
trying to speed you.
Oh, I'm giving you a hard time, Miller. So if we look at those who we think will feature on Sunday, I mean, if Scott Dixon comes away with his second Indy 500, I won't be mad. But
nobody,
what do we think?
I actually was going to go with Hunter Ray as well. So
you're
like
a little
when
mad
he,
when he beat
you
to too,
it.
Then.
Yeah, I was going to pick Hunter Ray, and then my second choice would be Dixon. It's part of like being on pole. It feels like there's so much that can happen in this race that it just doesn't. I don't know. For some reason, it's like it should be like more chance to win if you're on the pole. But for some reason, it just feels like that's too easy for this race. You know, it feels like it's it needs to be like a surprise. You know, so that's why I'm thinking Hunter Ray is my top pick, and then I think Dixon, and I'm going to go Kanaan as my third choice.
Wow!
If I had a fourth, I'd go Fernando, honestly.
So Michael, obviously, if your team can't win.
We don't want anybody to win that.
if you're having to play prognosticator, what are some of the other teams you think that might get to victory lane first?
Honestly, it's so hard to pick because there are 18 or 19 quality combinations out there. I agree with your assessment, Robin's assessment. Ryan Hunter Ray, don't ever count that guy out. Scott Dixon is perfection. Something, you know, the anvil has to fall out of the sky for something to keep Scott from featuring in this thing. Tony Kanaan is a machine. Unbelievable. If I had to pick a dark horse, Rossi's got the skills and he's done it before. Obviously, Alonso. My favorite dark horse, and a guy that I know has got the skills to do it and just impressed the hell out of me in 2013, is Marco Andretti.
Ooh, I like it. Bringing the heat.
So I'm gonna put Marco Andretti as perhaps a sentimental favorite, a quiet month. But that guy, he knows what a good race car feels like. He knows what he needs, and he's well capable of doing it. So if he can keep from having bad luck in the pits, bad luck timing with yellows, etc., I think you could see Marco really feature in this one.
And I can't wait to see what having Brian Herta on the timing stand here is going to do for Marco, keeping his head in the right place for 200 laps. We've never really seen that here, so I think that has great potential. I'm going to go with Dixon for the win, but I have two that you mentioned, one of them, two that I'm really keeping an eye on. Everyone's spoken about Rossi's win last year. The defending race winner, who was a rook, who set the fastest lap of the race last year, which folks seem to forget because his last couple laps were at 9 miles an hour to make it on fuel, qualified outside of the front row. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about someone who, okay, if you want to call his win last year a fluke, fine, go for it. I can tell you that the kid is A, bad fast, and B, has showed up this year quietly. It's kind of his personality. Mm-hmm. But you don't perform like he has without having the skill to repeat. So I would not be shocked. It would be a shock to see him go 2-for-2 at the Indy 500, but there's something about Rossi that I like. Tony Kanaan, our dear friend, had the rep for many, many years, and you were an engineer for him as well, Michael, as the best racer.
Oh, spectacular.
Once green flag, best racer in the field, Tony Kanaan. I would absolutely say the baton has been passed to Graham Rahal. That
yes.
kid,
yep. mm-hmm.
and doesn't always, you know, everything leading up to and through qualifying this year in particular hasn't been exactly what he wants. Setup has maybe not been perfect. It was great to see his teammate Oriol Servia qualify ahead of him, little nudge, you know, the second most popular Spaniard here, but number one in our hearts. But Graham, I tell you, he is just a kid that has come to a place in his career where I almost don't care where he starts. Let's just get to when it matters, and he and Eddie Jones and that team are going to get the car to where it should be, and that kid is going to put on a show. So,
yeah, I would agree with that assessment. Graham's done a very good job the past couple of years, just really taking responsibility for the race car.
Mm.
You know, okay, we didn't qualify very well. I'm going to take it to the front, and guess what he does? Yeah. So, I think that's a good bet as well. That's a problem in this series. I mean, there are so many quality combinations. You know, there's nobody you can look at week in, week out, and point to and go, they're a weakling. It doesn't exist.
The last one that I'll mention, just because it's my job, I'm fascinated to see how much your team can make out of the road course car with Davison in it, with Craig Hampson in it. I don't think anyone's pinning victory on that vehicle just because it doesn't have all the massaging and love that you would want it to have. But, you know, obviously a great opportunity for Sebs. We're putting him in the conversation for a win. I think that's gone out the window. But Davison charges like hell. I won't accuse the kid of being able to spell his name the same way twice. But regardless, Craig Hampson is a hell of an engineer. This Mike Cannon guy is not too bad. I think everyone's going to be watching Fernando Alonso for Rook of the Year, but I'm going to put my money on your little hot rod. What about you for Rook? What do you think, Steph?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really going to be quite a tight race between Ed and Fernando, because I think, you know, it's really easy to overlook what Ed's done because everyone's paying attention to what Fernando's doing. But, I mean, arguably, you know, it's really impressive what Ed has done. So I think it's just going to come down to who finishes higher in the race. You know, I think that's going to come down to it. So.
And if Ed doesn't win, then we know who to blame. All right, Michael.
That's exactly right. Yes, nicely done.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to have a fun close to the month here, and hopefully we have some more positive stories to tell once it's over.
Glad to be here. Anything for a free bottle of Dasani water.
Thanks for having us.